do something ahead of time so we can actually cover something interesting in the lecture. Okay, so what is a representation? First of all, I'm going to use a definition that is a little bit different than usual, but it's actually closer to what physicists actually do, which is why I'm using this definition. So let G be a matrix of the group. The finite dimensional complex vector space V is called a G module. This is the new definition that's a bit different than the usual representations. If there is a continuous action, and I'll explain what continuous means in a moment, over group G on this vector space. Now, before we go on, I'm going to use this to denote the action of a group element on a vector. I'm using the bracket notation here. So this triangle pointing to the right means G acts on psi, and so this denotes the action of G on psi. So this action needs to satisfy these two things. The first one is essential linearity. This action is linear. We're acting on a vector space, so we want to preserve the vector space structure. So if we act on a linear combination of vectors, this should be the same as taking a linear combination of the action. And the second property is essentially a homomorphism property. It tells you that if you compose the actions of two group elements, this should be the same as acting with the product of the two elements. Now, when I talk about the continuous action, in addition to this, we need to have that this map, the one that takes an element of the group and an element of the vector space, and associates to them the vector G acting on psi, should be continuous. And of course, this depends on what topology we have on this space. Vector spaces that are finite dimensional always have a nice topology that we can use, and G being a matrix group is a topology. Now, I was very restrictive in saying that this must be finite dimensional. You can do infinite dimensional vector spaces, and they are very important, but then you have to be very careful about what the topology is, what continuous means, so we're just not going to do it here. But it can be done. Another note, and this is just about names of things, the action of G on V is also called a representation of G on V. This is the usual name people use, and it looks a bit different because you use a map that goes from the group to something else, but really it's the same thing from a different point of view. This point of view is that we have a vector space, which is important, and we have an action of the group on it. Otherwise, usually you just have the group as the important object, and the vector space is just something that you use to represent it. And in physics, the vector space is very important. It's going to end up being the Hilbert space of a quantum theory, for example. Okay, let's see an example of this. Okay, let's call Vn the vector space which is spanned by a single vector. So this is a one-dimensional vector space, and really can be any vector space you want. I'm really generic here, but at the end of the day, all one-dimensional vector spaces are isomorphic, so it doesn't matter which one we choose. And I want an action of U1, the circle group on it. So how do we find this action? Well, let's take an element e to the I theta of U1, and I'm going to define how it acts on the vector n this way. E to the I theta acting on n is e to the I theta to the power n times n. And this is the same as e to the I n theta. Here n is just some fixed integer. It must be an integer because otherwise this step here doesn't work. In general, exponentiating complex numbers is not as easy as it looks, so you may end up with things that are a bit tricky. So for example, if you take the square root of a complex number, so n 1/2, you cannot just pass it through here. It's going to end up creating some problems. Specifically, you may pick up a plus or minus sign depending on the value of theta. Now, the action, I define it only for n, but you can define it for any other vector by linearity, because we want the action to be linear. So I'm just going to say, well, if I have another vector, say alpha times n, that's the only thing you can get in here because everything is a linear combination, is a scalar multiple of n. I'm just going to take the alpha and pull it out. So by definition, this is going to be a linear action. Now let's check that this is actually satisfying the homomorphism property. If z and w are in U1, so these are essentially phase factors, they are on the unit circle, then Z acting on W acting on N is going to be Z acting on W to the N times the vector N. But as I said before, this is a scalar, and we can just pull it out. So we end up with this, Z to the N times W to the N, and only because N is an integer, this ends up being the same as Z times W to the N. This is very important. If N is not an integer, this step doesn't work, which means we're not going to end up with a G module. Okay, let's see another example, which is really the same one with a small extension. Let's take the same vector space as before, still with N fixed integer, and we're going to use the same action, but we can actually extend it. Instead of just U1, we're going to extend it to any non-zero complex number. And non-zero complex numbers are the group GL1C. So we can just define Z acts on N by taking Z to the N times N. And we've just seen in the previous example that indeed, if we use this definition, then it satisfies the homomorphism property. And the linearity property is just in there by definition. So these are two examples of G modules for two different groups. So same vector space, different groups. The first one is U1, the second one is GL1C. Okay, so another important notion is that of a unitary G module. So let V be a G module. We say it's unitary if it has an inner product, so there's some inner product on this vector space, and the action of G is unitary. And if we want to write this explicitly, this means that if you take the inner product of the action of G on psi, and then you take the inner product with phi, take the complex conjugate, this is the same as the inner product of psi g to the minus 1 acting on phi. Now this may look a bit weird, but essentially what we're saying is, with some abusive notation, that g dagger, or in some sense the conjugate transpose of the action of g, is the same as taking the inverse of g. This is what we're saying. And we have to write it in this way simply because the bracket notation doesn't allow us to write it in a simpler way. But hopefully you've seen things like this already. If you take the complex conjugate of an expected value, it's the same as taking the expected value by flipping over. Well, this is not an expected value. If it was psi, and psi would be an expected value. But if we take the complex conjugate, we can switch over the role of psi and phi. So we're going to have psi on the left, phi on the right, and we're going to have the adjoint in the middle. So in this sense, adjoint equals inverse. Okay, so let's see the examples from before in light of this definition. So take Vn as the vector space from before. We're going to define an inner product by saying, well, n inner product with n is 1. This is actually the only thing we can do. We can make this any other number we want, but it must be positive. And at the end of the day, we're just rescaling things. So there's really only one choice of inner product on this space. Now for the action of U1, let's see what happens. If we act with e to the I theta, and we take the inner product between n and n, that's the only thing we can do because there's only one vector up to scalar multiples. And we take the complex conjugate, we're going to get, first of all, let's act with e to the I theta to get e to the I n theta. Now e to the I n theta is just a scalar number, we can pull it out of the inner product. But the inner product is 1, and this is e to the I n theta. If you take the complex conjugate, it's going to be e to the minus I n theta. On the other end, if we take the inner product of n, the inverse of e to the I theta, acting on n, we're going to have n e to the minus I theta, because this is the inverse of e to the I theta, acting on n. But this is e to the minus I n theta. This is a scalar. We can pull it out. And as before, inner product of n with n is 1. So because these two things end up being the same, this means that Vn is unitary. If we look at the action of GL1C, we're going to find instead that the action of z to the minus 1, same steps as before, is going to end up with z to the minus n. So it's exactly the same steps as this, so I'm not doing them again. On the other hand, the inner product of n, z acting on n, complex conjugate, is going to be the complex conjugate of inner product of n, z to the n, n, but this is a scalar, we can pull it out, and we end up with z bar to the n, the complex conjugate of z to the n. And in general, this is not the same as z to the minus n, not for every complex number at least. The only case in which it happens if is n equals 0. So Vn is not unitary unless n is 0, from the point of view of the GL1C action. Okay, at this point we can look at representations or modules of the algebras instead. Let fracture G be a algebra. A finite dimensional complex vector space V is a G module, a fracture G module. I realize that I say G module when I say two different things, so I'm going to try to say fracture G module all the time. If there is an action of fracture G on the vector space, satisfying this. So again, the notation is if X is an element of fracture G, then X with this triangle means X acting on. So the first thing is the same as before, it must be linear. If we act on a linear combination, we should get a linear combination of the actions. But also, because fracture G is a vector space itself, if we act with a linear combination of the algebra elements, we should get a linear combination of their actions. And finally, because it's a Lie algebra, it also has a Lie bracket. And the Lie bracket should also act in a compatible way. And the compatible way is, if we act with the Lie bracket of x and y, this should be the same as acting with x, acting with y first, then acting with x, so we're composing the actions, minus acting with x first, and then acting with y. And this very much looks like the xy minus yx idea. So this is the definition of the action over the algebra on a vector space. And similarly, we're going to say that V is unitary as a fracture G module if it has an inner product, and this time this happens. If you take the complex conjugate of inner product of phi x acting on psi, this is just going to pick a minus sign and it's going to swap the rule on psi and phi. In terms of this adjoint notion, we're saying that the adjoint of x as it acts on vectors is the same as minus x. So the action is anti-Hermitian. Now, if it's anti-Hermitian, well, we will call it unitary, not anti-Hermitian. This is an abuse of notation, and the reason why is that we'll see that representations or modules of the algebras come from representations of G modules. Not all the time, but if you have a G module representation, you can get a fracture G module as well. And if it's unitary for the G module, it's going to become unitary for the fracture G module, so for the Lie algebra level. And unitary in the sense that this happens at the Lie algebra level. So we just use the same name regardless. Okay, so I have an example here. I'm not going to go through it because I don't want to spend too much time on this video. You can look at this example on your own. It should be familiar because this is just SU2, which I hope that at this some point in your quantum mechanics course or courses you have seen, because this is very important. It has to do with angular momentum. So you can look at this particular example on your own. Okay, so finally, today we're getting to symmetries in quantum mechanics. It's been a while. That's what I wanted to do from the very beginning. I was supposed to have two lectures about this, but we're behind, so we just get one. But I try to pack as much as I can in here without making it way too much. Before we start, are there any questions about anything so far or the video that I sent you yesterday? Okay, well, as usual, if you have questions, just put them in the chat or raise your hand, and we'll get them during the lecture. Okay, so these things are actually
not supposed to be in here, so I'm going to delete these pages. You can see everything disappear in real time today. Okay, symmetries in quantum mechanics. To understand symmetries in quantum mechanics, we're going to use Wigner's theorem. Now, before we get to this theorem, let's remember what a symmetry is. In the very first lecture, we defined the symmetry to be something which is a transformation of some object, whatever that is, that leaves something else invariant. If we're working in quantum mechanics, we're going to have the space where we live, theory-wise, is going to be the Hilbert space. So we want to do something to the Hilbert space. That's going to be our thing that we transform. And when we say we want to leave things invariant, well, we want to leave the physics invariant. That's going to be what a symmetry is. But there's something special about things that satisfy this property. So something that transforms Hilbert space into itself and preserves the physics or leaves it invariant must behave in a very specific way. And that's what Wigner's theorem tells us. So let's look at what this is. Suppose we have a map T from Hilbert space H to itself. We want it to be invertible because we're trying to describe symmetries, and symmetries should be invertible, as we discussed in the first lecture. Now, among the other things, we would really like for symmetries to preserve transition amplitudes, because those are very physical quantities. And remember, transition amplitudes are these things. If you have two vectors psi and phi in an Hilbert space, there's a very good reason why I didn't use the bracket notation here. It just doesn't work because of what I had to write here. So this is a transition amplitude. It tells you how probable it is that if you're in state psi, you're going to end up in state psi instead or measure state psi. You might have seen it just as this part in your quantum mechanics courses, and that's because usually you assume states to be normalized to one. If they're not normalized, then you have to normalize them. So you're going to end up with these two extra factors at the bottom. Now, what does it mean that T preserves transition amplitudes? It means that if you take phi and send it to T of phi, and psi and send it to T of psi, and replace this everywhere in this expression, you're not going to change the answer. And this is true for every two vectors in the Hilbert space. And this here is the reason why the bracket notation doesn't work. I never say that T is a linear map. The bracket notation only works for linear things. So when we try to define this for generic T, the bracket notation fails. Okay, so Wigner's theorem tells us this. Under these assumptions and some extra things that I should say, I'm putting a lot of stuff under the rug. We have an Hilbert space, we need to worry about this topology, these transformations must be nice. There's a domain to worry about. I'm ignoring all of these things because it's way too much work, but you can make this thing formal. Okay, so under these and some extra nice assumptions, one of the two following things happens. Either T is linear and unitary, at least up to a multiplicative constant. So it could be unitary, but then it multiplies also everything by three, for example. Or T is antilinear and anti-unitary. In case you don't know what antilinear and anti-unitary means, don't worry, we don't care today, because we're only going to consider the first case. But essentially, an antilinear map is one that is linear with respect to real scalar multiplication, but then it changes the complex numbers by complex conjugating them. So it's not really a linear map per se. Okay, so this is the theorem. We're not going to prove it. If you're interested in the proof, you can just Google Wigner's theorem and you're going to find lots of different proofs. Okay, so why is this important? As I said before, symmetry should preserve the physics. And in particular, this is a necessary condition. It doesn't mean that if they preserve transition amplitudes, they're symmetries, but if they are symmetries, they need to preserve transition amplitudes, which means they either act as unitary or anti-unitary operators on the Hilbert space, up to a multiplicative constant. But why are we going to ignore antilinear and anti-unitary ones? Well, the identity is unitary because it just acts as identity and it's linear. And the identity should be a symmetry. Now, if G is a connected group of symmetries, connected in the sense that we saw last time, then by continuity, G must act in a unitary way because everything is connected in a continuous way to the identity. So if you move from identity to something else, you cannot jump to anti-unitary all of a sudden. If it was unitary, it must stay unitary. So as it turns out, anti-unitary actions are used for things like time reversal. And we're going to ignore this for now because we really don't have time to do everything. Now, this whole thing sounds very much like unitary representations. We have symmetries that are operators that act on a vector space. There was the whole idea of unitary operator representations, and the action is unitary. So it sounds very much like what we were talking about, well, what I told you about in the video that I sent you yesterday. Actually, we did talk about representations last time. Is really used for quantum mechanics. I wasn't just doing math things. There's a reason why we talked about representations. And from my point of view, this is not a mathematician's point of view. The mathematicians study representations for lots of interesting things. The reason why we care about representations is because of quantum mechanics. Okay, so given these ideas, let's go back to representations and we're going to find something very cool that happens in quantum mechanics. Okay, suppose we have a V vector space, which is a G module. And remember, that means that we have an action of the group G, which is continuous and it's linear and it satisfies the homomorphism property. We can always take this G module and make it into a Lie algebra module or the Lie algebra associated to G. And the way we do it is let X be an element of the Lie algebra. We can always say that X equals the derivative with respect to epsilon at epsilon equals zero of e to the epsilon X. And these things make sense because these are just matrices. This is the matrix exponential. And this is actually an equality and it does make sense. But then we might think, well, if I know how the group acts on the vector space, and we know how e to the epsilon x acts on g, or on psi. So we know this. If we know this, and we know that we can get x by taking the derivative, does it make sense to define the action of x on this vector space by taking the derivative of the action of e to the epsilon x? And as it turns out, the answer is yes, this makes perfect sense. And if you're wondering, but what does this really mean? How do we take the derivative of the action on a vector? If you write this as the limit as epsilon goes to zero, 1/ε, and then we're going to have e to the epsilon x acting on psi minus e to the zero x, which is the identity. Acting on psi, then this makes more sense. Because assuming we have a nice topology to take these limits with in the vector space, this is an element of the vector space. So is this, and you can subtract two elements of the vector space, they're going to stay in. So the only thing that you have to worry about is, does this limit actually converge? But once that's done, everything is fine. So you can make this thing formal. And I'm going to show you an example so we are going to be grounded in reality instead of this just weird formula. But the point is, if we have a G module, we can go to a Lie algebra module by taking a derivative. I'm going to pause this for a moment so I can scroll to the next page and you can still see what's happening. Let's start this again. And as usual, if you have questions, like I know that I may be going a bit fast on these things. If you have questions or if I'm going too fast, please let me know. Okay, so the example is going to be based on the examples that were in the video that I sent you yesterday. So suppose we have the vector space I'm going to call V with the subscript N, which is a one-dimensional vector space with only one vector up to scalar multiplication in it. And so the basis is going to be this ket n, and n is a fixed integer. We're going to say that e to the I theta, which is an element of U1, acts on n by sending us to e to the I n theta, acting on n. But now we can look at I, which is an element of the Lie algebra fracture U1, which is just a derivative as epsilon goes to zero of e to the I epsilon. And in fact, fracture U1 is just going to be the span of I. It's a one-dimensional Lie algebra because it has only one vector linearly independent. And you just get them by scaling this I by any real number. So this is just going to be the set of the I theta such that theta is in R. Okay, so let's see what happens and why this makes sense. We're going to say that I acting on n is defined as the derivative respect to epsilon of e to the I epsilon acting on n at epsilon equals zero. And as I said before, this is just this limit. But now, this thing here is just e to the I n epsilon acting on n. And this thing is just n. So we didn't change n, we just have this vector, and we can just factor it out. So we're going to have the limit on its own times the vector n. N doesn't care about the limit. And this particular limit is the derivative with respect to epsilon of e to the I n epsilon at epsilon equals zero, which is I n. So all this sends us to this equality. So I acting on n is the same as I n acting on n. Now at this point, I want to address something because it's a big source of confusion. In this equation, we have I on both sides, but they live in different places. This I lives in U1, fracture U1. It's an element of the Lie algebra. This I lives in the complex numbers, in the sense that they are the scalars of the vector space. It's a very important distinction and it's very confusing, but you should think of this thing here as some abstract objects. They happen to look like complex numbers because you are using matrix Lie groups and matrix Lie algebras. But if you were thinking of U1 as something different, as a group of transformations, for example, instead of a group of matrices, then this would be some abstract transformation instead of being a number. So I know this can be confusing and it's just something you're going to have to get used to, but it's important to point it out. Okay, so now this is indeed an action of U1, Lie algebra, so fracture U1 on our vector space V. I'm going to leave this to you to check out. It's not difficult because the Lie bracket is always zero, so it doesn't actually give you any new information. Now, something to note, the action of U1 is anti-Hermitian. And this means that by the definition that I gave you in the video, this is a unitary fracture U1 module. And this is exactly the reason why we define the unitary Lie algebra modules this way. Technically, there's nothing unitary happening here. We're just saying that the action is anti-Hermitian. Why don't we call them anti-Hermitian modules? And the reason why is that if you take a Lie group module and then you take a derivative and you make it into a Lie algebra module, if it was unitary with respect to the group, it becomes anti-Hermitian with respect to the Lie algebra. And we still call it unitary because we like unitary better than anti-Hermitian. Okay, I'm going to post this again and scroll a bit more. Okay, is it going okay so far? Am I going too fast or is it the pace okay? Okay. And now this is the most important question and the one that's going to have the applications in quantum mechanics. Does the converse work? So what I did right now is I took a Lie group representation and I made it into a Lie algebra representation. Can we do the converse? If I give you a Lie algebra representation, can I make it into a Lie group representation? Or if you want, you can think of the question in this way. Do all of the representations of the Lie algebra come from representations of the group with the procedure that I just showed you? Can you just get them by deriving them? Let's find out. I don't want to spoil the fun, so I'm not going to tell you yet. Let's define this new class of representations. These are of the Lie algebra. They look just like the ones from before. I define V with an alpha subscript. This time alpha can be any real number. Again, one dimensional. There's only one vector in those, which I denote by ket alpha. And the action is going to be I acting on alpha is I alpha ket alpha. And same as before, this I belongs to U1. This I alpha belongs to the complex numbers. So you should think of these as two separate entities, despite the fact that U1 is a subset of the complex numbers. They're just two different kinds of things. You can check yourself that this is a unitary U1 module, because if you take the complex conjugate of this quantity, so that's I acting on alpha, and then you sandwich it with another alpha, then you take the complex conjugate, you end up with pulling out an I alpha, complex conjugate it, you get the minus I alpha. But then if you pull it back inside, this is minus alpha I acting on alpha, which is minus the original thing. So this is anti-remission. And this is the reason why I chose alpha to be real. Now, I could have chosen alpha to be any complex number, but then this would not have been unitary. And we saw from Wigner's theorem that we only care about unitary things. We don't care about things that are non-unitary because they're not going to represent symmetries and they're not going to preserve the physics. Now, the question is, can we say that we can act with a U1 element? So you take an e to the I theta in U1, and you act on alpha in such a way that this is the same as the exponential of I theta acting on alpha. It's kind of the reverse of the procedure from before. So this is the reverse of I theta acting on alpha. Well, let's do n because it's the one we had before. Is the derivative with respect to epsilon of e to the I. I guess it would just be x, e to the epsilon x, acting on n at epsilon equals 0. It's the reverse of this question. Now, before we answer it, let's make this exponential more explicit. What do I mean by the exponential of this thing? Just as I had to define the derivative, I'm going to define this exponential. We just take this series. We're going to have I theta to the power n, so we're composing it with itself n times. So technically, this is an abusive notation. What I mean is that I theta squared is meant to be I theta acting on I theta. So we're composing things. So if I write I theta squared acting on alpha, I mean I theta acting on I theta acting on alpha. Just so this is clear what's happening. So we act with I theta n times, divide by n factorial, and act on alpha. And then we're going to sum all the possible values of n. So this looks just as the series for the exponential. So it looks like it makes sense. Okay, so first of all, I theta acting on ket alpha gives us I alpha theta ket alpha. And now if we act with I theta twice, we're going to get I theta acting on I alpha theta ket alpha. That's from the previous line. But then this I theta alpha is a scalar and we can pull it back outside because the action is linear. and we end up with I alpha theta squared times alpha. You can keep doing this, and you're just going to get power of I alpha theta to the n. So this means that the sum for n that goes from 1 to infinity of this thing is the same as this sum. Sum from n equal 1 to infinity, and then we have I alpha theta to the n over n factorial. And these are just scalars. So these are just complex numbers. This is a complex exponential, which always converges. And we're just multiplying always by the same vector, so we can just factor out all these things, and we don't have to worry about it. So we end up with this. E to the I theta alpha times alpha. So it looks like we have the action of e to the I theta on alpha is e to the I theta alpha acting on alpha. And I'm going to put a question mark here because there's a problem. What I've done so far has a big flaw in it. Does anyone notice something that I've done that doesn't make any sense? And before you go there, it's not the exponential or the series that actually makes sense. It's something way more basic. Okay, so if you've not noticed already, this is not something easy to notice. So I'm just going to tell you. But what's happening is my mistake was going from here to here. And the reason why is that this is an ambiguous equality. It doesn't make sense unless we make a choice. Let me explain what I mean. Again, I'm going to pause while I scroll so you can see this for a bit longer. Okay, so the problem is that the choice of theta is ambiguous in the sense that e to the I theta is the same as e to the I theta plus I 2 pi k for an integer. So this means that when I said, well, let's go from e to the I theta, I want to write it as the exponential of I theta acting on alpha. How did I choose the theta? Why did I choose that theta? Why didn't I shift it by 2 pi? I could have, and so I made a choice. So in order to make this actually work, we need to make some choice for theta. And for example, we can decide that theta is always going to be in between minus pi and pi, which is the standard choice when you work with complex analysis. So if you want to be precise, we're saying that if z is an element of u1, then the action of z on alpha is going to be given by this. We're going to have e to the I alpha arg z with the capital A. If you've seen this already, this is the principal argument. If you're not, it's just something that returns something in minus pi to pi, such that z equals absolute value of z e to the I arg z. So it's a way of getting the face of this complex number, but it only gives you something that's in between minus pi and pi. So for example, arg of e to the I 3 pi is going to be pi, not 3 pi, because it needs to make sure that it's going to be in the interval minus pi to pi. Okay, so we fixed the problem. Now everything seems well. But we actually need to check that this is a U1 module. We need to check that it satisfies all the nice properties that we need. So first of all, it is linear because of the way we defined it. Or if you want, we're going to extend its action on the vector space by linearity. If I know that Z acts on the basis this way, I'm just going to say, well, Z acts on 2 times alpha by multiplying this answer by 2. So it's going to be linear by definition. Now, what happens if you try to compose the action of two elements of U1? So we have Z and W in U1, and we do Z acting on W acting on alpha. So the first one gives you, and there's a typo here, it gives you an e to the I alpha arg or W. This is a scalar, so we can pull it out. And then we're going to have the action of Z on alpha, and this gives us e to the I alpha arc Z, e to the I alpha arc W. And we can put this together in one exponential, and it's e to the I alpha arc Z plus arc W. And now the problem is that in general, arc Z plus arc W is not the same as arc of Z plus W. It's going to be arc of Z plus W up to either adding to pi or taking away to pi or doing nothing, depending on what we are. So for example, if we sum pi over 2 and pi over 2, that's going to be fine. But if we have a phase which is pi and a phase which is pi, they sum to 2 pi, but that's outside of our range, and we need to subtract. So it really depends on what we're doing. So for example, if we have the action of e to the I pi and then acting on e to the I pi, this is going to give us e to the alpha 2 pi alpha. But is this equal, and that's a question, to e to the I pi times e to the I pi acting on alpha? And it turns out it depends on alpha, because this thing should be just identity. This is e to the I pi, which is minus 1 times minus 1. This is just 1. And so this will just equal alpha. Let's see if it actually satisfies the equality. So notice that e to the I alpha arc Z plus arc W, same typo twice. This equals e to the I alpha arc Z plus W times e to the 2 pi alpha k, where the k is the one from here. It's either going to be 0 or 1 or minus 1. But this thing is in general different than 1. If, for example, k is non-zero and alpha is not an integer. For a concrete example, let's see what happens if alpha is 1 half. We have e to the I pi acting on e to the I pi acting on 1 half equals e to the I pi 1 half. Because we have alpha is 1 half divided by 2 pi, 2 pi divided by alpha, or multiplied by alpha, gives you I pi, but this is minus ket 1 half, but it's not the same as e to the I pi, e to the I pi, which is the identity acting on 1 half. So we picked up a minus sign along the way. So at this point, you might think, well, is everything broken? And we're going to have a cliffhanger now, because I'm not going to tell you yet. I'm going to instead show you the GeoGebra thing that I made that I hope is going to make this whole thing a lot clearer. Okay, so as usual, you can get the link on the Google Drive, or I'll just send it to you. So you can just click on it in the chat. Just give me a moment to actually find my file. Okay, so as usual, I encourage you to actually play with the sliders and see what's happening for yourself instead of just having me do it. But the idea here is that we have this circle here, where we have Z and W, which are elements of U1. They are on the unit circle. You can move them around and you can see that this map F is defined by assigning to Z e to the I alpha rz. That's essentially what we're doing in the map that we are using when we do the representation. And notice that depending on the value of alpha, Z times W is sent somewhere, but F of Z times F of W is sent somewhere else. But it really depends on alpha, because if I choose alpha to be an integer, then they end up in the same place, no matter what. Which makes sense, because we've seen earlier that the Lie algebra representations where alpha is an integer, they come from the Lie group. But when alpha is not an integer, then sometimes it works, but then as you move one of the points around, things like this happen. All of a sudden, they jump to a different place. And if you want to see what happens for a specific W, just choose Z to be one, so that Z times W is W. And you can see if you move things around, what happens. Now, this looks like it's fine. Let's choose a different value, say something closer to one off. As you move things around, you're going to notice that there's going to be jumps. For example, we're jumping completely this half of the circle. We're going from here, then we go all the way here, and then we come back from here. So this points out two things. First of all, as we've seen, this is not satisfying the homomorphism property. And actually, it also breaks the fact that it should be continuous because we're making a jump. We're going from something that looks like this to all of a sudden something looks like this. So there's two things that we broke with this particular example. Okay, so back to the lecture, but you have access to this if you want to investigate more. Back to the question, did we break everything? Actually, no, we did not break anything at all. Because now you should remember something, and to do this, I'm going to show you the PDF. If I find it. Okay, I'm just going to show you in the browser because I don't know where I put it. So if you go back to our material, if you remember the notes that I sent you at the very beginning, even before we started your lectures, the review of the equivalence classes, there was an example at the end about the projective Hilbert space. Now we're not going to go through the whole projective Hilbert space idea, but the point was that because we have an Hilbert space in which all we care about is not the actual states in the Hilbert space, but the physical quantities end up being the transition amplitudes and the expectation values of observables. And those are completely unaffected by rescaling of the vectors. If I have psi, a state psi, and then I take another state phi, which is lambda times psi, then all the physics is going to be completely unaffected by this change. The expectation values are the same, the transition amplitudes are the same. And this means that these two states are physically indistinguishable. And so you can define an equivalence relation and say that they are equivalent if they are proportional to each other. And then you can construct equivalence classes with respect to this relation. So all we need is this idea of equivalence classes. So to recap, remember that psi and lambda psi are equivalent as long as lambda is non-zero. But this means that if you get the equivalence class of e to the I pi acting on e to the I pi acting on one half, as we've seen, this gives you a minus one half and it stays inside the equivalence class. But the equivalence class of minus ket one half is the same as ket one half because they're just differing by a constant. And this is e to the I to pi acting on one half. So from the point of view of the physics, this actually does satisfy the homomorphism property because you cannot distinguish the two results. And in general, you can see that with our action, we get Z acting on W acting on alpha equals ZW acting on alpha. Now, this is a very important result for many reasons. But the idea is that when I told you at the beginning, oh, it looks like symmetries in quantum mechanics are unitary representations. They're not just unitary representations. Those are an example, but if we go back to the very beginning, which is here, I told you that the unitarity of the action was up to a multiplicative constant, which means that we need to consider something more general than what we've done so far. So we call this thing a projective representation. Which means that it's not really a representation, it does not satisfy the properties, but it satisfies them if you put everything in equivalence classes. Now, this is not the most general definition of projective representation. I don't want to go there because it takes too much setting up. But the important part about it is that from the physical point of view, even though if we take a Lie algebra representation and we try to exponentiate it, it's not a representation anymore, we still like it from the physical point of view. Okay, so this is the end of what I've written, but I have more things to say. But before I say these things, are things kind of clear to everyone? Is there anything I can clarify about these things? So I'm going to write this in a different way. So in general, if we have an action of a group, which is G acting on Psi, so G acting on H acting on Psi. And this action gives you something like this. It's not exactly GH acting on Psi, but there's something else here. So something like, say, a phase factor that depends on G and H. If you get something like this, this is a projective representation. And this still describes symmetry. So we need to be more general than just representations to describe symmetries in quantum mechanics. And while this seems like a very strange thing that we have to worry about is why do we have to do this? Can we just use representations? This is very important because this is exactly the reason why you have fermions and you have one-half spin in quantum mechanics. So we're going to see this in a moment, well, just a general idea, not to prove anything. But the idea is this. What are the nice thing that happens? And we're going to assume here that V is finite dimensional. So these things that I'm about to say, they work if the representations are finite dimensional. If they're not finite dimensional, sometimes they work, sometimes you need to do something different. So we're not going to go there. But in many cases of interest, we are going to end up with finite dimensional representations. So we're going to be happy about these things. Okay, so the first thing that happens is that the projective representations of G, and again, they are only the finite dimensional ones, are all obtained by exponentiating with the procedure that we saw before. Representations of the Lie algebra of G, and I'm assuming here also that G is connected. I should also add this. And when I say representations of the Lie algebra of G, I'm going to write pure representations, so they're not projective. So this is something that happens, and there's two very nice things about this. So this statement is nice for two very important things. The first one is that this is telling us you can find projected representations by looking at pure representations of something else. And as it happens, we don't like projected representations. There's nothing wrong with them, mathematically speaking, but they are very difficult to work with. They have a lot of extra baggage, which is they are defined in terms of equivalence classes. While pure representations are just linear maps. And if there's one thing we know how to do, it's linear algebra. This is exactly the same reason why we use Hilbert spaces instead of projective Hilbert spaces when we do quantum mechanics. Yes, the actual physical states are in the projective Hilbert space, but then it's not a vector space anymore, and we lack linear algebra. So that's one thing. And the second thing, so let me actually write this. So the first thing for which this is nice is we use pure representations of the algebra instead of projective representations of G. So really it's pure representations versus projective representations. And the second reason why is that the representations of the Lie algebra are easier to find than representations of G. So even if you were not trying to fix the problem of worrying about projected representations in general, finding a representation of a Lie algebra is considerably easier than finding those of a group. And the reason why is that the representation of a Lie algebra, especially if it's finite dimensional, is a pure linear algebra problem. I give you a vector space and I ask you, how can you construct an action of the Lie algebra that satisfies all the constraints we need? And if I give you this problem and I freeze it appropriately and I don't tell you anything about Lie algebras, and you don't know what Lie algebras are, but you know everything about linear algebra, you are still going to be able to solve the problem. While if you try to do the same thing for groups, it becomes a lot more complicated. The cases in which you can actually find representations of groups directly, they involve functional analysis and you have to use function spaces and you have to use topology, probably some differential geometry. It's not easy at all. While you can do representations of Lie algebras quite easily. And by the way, this is what you usually do in physics. You have all seen examples of this because most things we do in physics are representations of Lie algebra, but well, in quantum physics, not all physics. So for example, when you look at the spectrum of the harmonic oscillator, you are finding a Lie algebra representation. When you look at the spectrum of angular momentum, you are looking at the Lie algebra representation. And those are not too complicated because they are algebraic in nature. Okay, so this is the first nice thing that happens. And we could stop here. This is nice, but there's something else that happens. And again, this is assuming assuming finite dimensional representations. And what happens is that the projective representations of G are in, and I'm going to put it in bunny quotes because this requires a bit of being careful when I say one-to-one correspondence. With pure representations of G tilde. Now this G tilde is a simply connected cover of G. And you have no idea what it means, that's perfectly fine. This is a topological concept. This cover thing is a topological concept. But as with many things here, you don't really need to know what the cover is and what a simply connected cover is. So this whole thing, by the way, is called the universal cover. What you need to know is how to Google things and how to Google table Lully groups. And you're going to see that it says the simply connected cover of this group is this other group. And that's all you need to know. And no one expects you to go and figure out on your own what the connected cover of something is just for fun. I mean, someone had to do it at some point, but they've done it. Why do we have to do it again? So examples of these things are, so this should look familiar. SO N, well, this is SO3. The universal cover of SO3 is SU2. And by the way, in case you're wondering, why do you say the universal cover? Can there be more than one? As it turns out, it's unique up to isomorphism. So we can say that it equals SU2 in the sense that if it's something else, it's going to be isomorphic to SU2 in the sense of isomorphism that we talked about last time. So this means that instead of projective representations of SO3, we can look at representations of SU2. So this is the approach that's usually taken, and especially when you want to be lazy about it. So it's entirely possible that if you have seen something about groups in your quantum mechanics courses, you were told in quantum mechanics, instead of SU3, we're going to use SU2 as a group because this way it works. But no one really tells you why. And I don't know, maybe your book actually told you everything and what I'm telling you, you knew already. But the reason why is that it is not very nice to work with projected representations and even talk about projected representations. They're not easy to understand at all. I sometimes still find it difficult to really understand what they're about. And I'm teaching the whole course on them. Well, the course was not on them, but they are in the course that I'm teaching. So I really cannot stress enough how much we hate projected representations. We really, really don't like them. And there's nothing wrong with them. We just don't like them. It happens. So there are two ways to get rid of them. You either just go at the Lie algebra level and do everything there, which by the way is what we end up doing anyway, even when we go and use this approach instead, because then when you want to do the representations of G tilde, how do you do them? You look at the Lie algebra level. Or we just say, well, let's replace our group with something that's supposed to be the proper symmetry group. So instead of SO3, which is rotations, you use SU2, which is rotations plus other stuff in a way that is simply connected. So these, hopefully you've seen, I cannot prove these things to you. I had this whole plan of actually going through the representations of SU2 and SU3. There was supposed to be a last lecture, but we don't have time for an extra lecture. But I hope that you've seen this already. The projective representations of SO3, they are labeled by a number that we call J, which describes angular momentum, which can be the projected representations. So we have zero. Let me do everything step by step. The pure representations of SO3, they are labeled by 0, 1, 3. Sorry, what am I saying? 2, 3, and so on. All integers. While the projective representations of SO3, they're going to be labeled by J equals 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, 2, and so on. So it's half integer steps. Notice that these things include everything that's in here. Because projected representations are more general. They include all the representations, the pure ones, plus extra stuff. So you should have seen these things already. Usually when you do angular momentum and you're told things such as, oh, you have JZ acting on JM equals M JM and J plus minus JM equals C plus minus JM plus minus one. When you're told this thing, this is a Lie algebra representation. So this is a representation of SO3 factor. And these things are labeled by 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, 2, and so far. But these representations are at the Lie algebra level. If you want to pull them up to the group, you're not going to get all of them. Some of them are going to fail, just like we've seen before for U1. So only the integers one, I'm going to be fine and end up with poor representations of SO3. The other ones are going to fail and they're going to be projected representations. But as I stated already a few times, we really don't like projected representations. So instead, we're going to work with pure representations of SU2. And these again, they're going to be labeled by J equals 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, and so on. So you essentially have three ways of looking at things. You can either just go at the Lie algebra level, which is what you usually do anyway in physics, because you mostly care about what happens with infinitesimal transformations, and so with things in the Lie algebra, rather than the whole group structure. Same thing happens with Noether's theorem. Yes, you can prove that something is a global symmetry as an actual group action, or you can just look at what happens infinitesimally, check if delta S is zero, rather than the actual action being invariant. And if that's true, that's good enough for you. So that's one option. Or you can work with the projected representations of SO3, which I advise against because they're not nice. So this is what you usually end up doing. And really, this ends up being pure representations of SO3, Lie algebra, which by the way, is isomorphic to the Lie algebra of SU2. Which makes sense because you should be able to go between all these options at the same time. And this is the only consistent option. So again, J is 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, and so on. So the idea here is that in quantum mechanics, almost everything we do has to do with representation theory. And while technically you need to allow for projective representations, in most cases you can get away with doing pure representations of something else. The something else can either be a Lie algebra or some other group which covers your original one and it's simply connected. So those are essentially your options. And this is the end of the lecture. And we have still quite a bit of time. So at this point, first of all, if anything is not clear, let me know because we have time to go over it. So I'll give you a couple of minutes to think about that.